What is up, wrestling fans? Welcome to the Smile Count Moments Smack Talk podcast. We're episode 3 of the Paul Heyman SmackDown series that we're doing right now, where we go back in time to the year 2002 and check out the episode of SmackDown where Paul Heyman was the lead writer. And who's joining me on this journey? Well, me, I'm Callum Wiggins, and joining me is, as always, Robert DeFelice.
How are we doing today, Callum? What are we covering?
We're covering the July the 11th, 2002 episode of SmackDown, as well as all the other like news and events that's taking place. I guess bury the lead a little bit for this episode. It's not as good as the last one, but we'll still get a lot of laughs out of the way, as we always do. So we just want to encourage everyone to like the video if you're enjoying it, and if you don't enjoy it, don't leave a dislike, because that's mean. Leave your comments below, leave your thoughts about this episode of SmackDown. If you're listening to this on like any of our podcast feeds, and hopping over to YouTube, if you want to get involved in the conversation, leave the comments below. If you haven't checked out this episode of SmackDown and you want to after we review it, then there will be a link in the description for you to check it out on the WWE Network. But I think we can just barrel on through and get started with this one.
All right.
So, as always, we'll start off with just a review of what the news and events were at this point in time. There wasn't really that much exciting, gripping news, which is probably a good thing because it means we can get into the real meat of the episode soon. But the biggest story that I could tell from my diving through the observers was that there was a backstage producers meeting between like Raw and SmackDown crews, where they just all got together with Vince and went through a few details. And there was a general consensus and feeling that the SmackDown crew was a lot more organised and put together than the Raw crew was. And that was a point of discontent between the different sides of the brand war at this point in time.
I feel like that could be, well, Heyman is used to running a ship and he runs a tight ship. He's not as, you know, scrutinised as McMahon or anything, but he's known for running a very tight ship, and I believe Eric Bischoff recently was quoted as saying he's quirky as fuck.
That's a nice quote. Yeah. He's always been very, I mean, you hear the stories about ECW all the time of the fact that even though they weren't getting paid on time and all the rest of this, they all wanted to just do well for Paul Heyman because he has that drink the Kool-Aid mentality about him.
It's something that even all these years later, you know, he still has it. People still feel that way about Paul Heyman, and it's his unifying quality, really.
It is quite something that's a little lost at the moment because obviously Brock Lesnar's not on TV due to COVID-19 stuff, and so Heyman has been off TV for the vast duration since WrestleMania. So we're not getting any of the sign of that, and there's no real sign that he's obviously not influencing backstage as much as he used to anymore because he's not the head writer or head creative director for Raw anymore. So maybe that's being lost on people now.
Yeah, and now it's more of a unified vision under one Bruce Pritchard, and I'm sure back in 2002, Brian Gewirtz would have liked it to be a unified vision under Brian Gewirtz.
So let's check out the ratings war for this week. So the Raw episode, which was the 8th of July episode, drew a 3.7 rating. The SmackDown episode, which we're covering, the July the 11th edition, a 3.75. So we're going to count that as a tie again, because it is like just too close for comfort, really. So no discernible sign of either show being above the other one at this point. At this moment in the ratings war.
And that's fair. You know, it's just starting out. We haven't even gotten to the time frame where it's separate championships and whatnot.
So let's see what Raw was doing. Just have a brief cursory look at what the competition was up to at this point in time. The main event of the previous episode of Raw was a 10-man tag involving the NWO teaming with Chris Benoit and Eddie Guerrero to face RVD, Booker T, Goldust, Bubba Ray Dudley, and Spike Dudley.
And the only noteworthy event of this match is, tell him, Callum.
Well, it was X-Pac's final match of the
Course.
No, it was Kevin Nash trying to run from one side of the ring to the other and collapsing in the opposition corner because he had torn one of his quadriceps.
Yep, I remember this so well, because I remember just thinking, what happened? Why is he, like, the throwing up the X, it's all really serious, and I couldn't figure out where something went wrong for Kevin Nash to suddenly be, you know, in excruciating pain.
I think the thing that I take out of it the most, which outside of the absolute hilarity of just a huge man falling over and just collapsing in pain because of him walking, let alone doing anything else, it's the instantaneous, like, everybody gets in the ring and starts brawling. Like, it's how quickly the wrestlers react to, oh God, something's gone horribly, horribly wrong. What we do? And then just everyone start brawling and see what happens.
Yeah, I don't know if you would see that today, like that instantaneous, you know, think on our feet, let's just get in here and distract from the real situation that's going on.
Well, I think the last real cases that this really would have happened would be the, I'm guessing like the Jericho, he'd fight Neville.
Jericho,
wasn't it?
And Neville, yeah.
Yeah, and so Neville, I think, tore some sort of ligament in his leg or something.
Like an ankle injury.
Oh, yeah.
He really tried to quickly pin him, and the referee just wouldn't go for it. That's another one of those, look at how much times have changed, because now things are so to a T and by the book that if they didn't follow every single spot, the referee's confused, the talent's confused, it's all just a mess.
So that incident essentially killed the NWO angle. And then next week on Raw, Vince McMahon actually has to come out on TV and just say that the NWO doesn't exist anymore.
I think they made a mistake by not keeping Waltman.
I think Waltman at the time was having a few problems, and I mean, there is X-Pac heat for a reason. And it's
because he would have still fit into what they were about to do with Hunter and Shawn.
It's just the fact that Waltman wasn't even 30 at this point in his career.
What?
He was in his late 20s.
Get out of here.
Yeah, he was in 2002. He might have just turned 30, but he definitely wasn't any older than that.
Wow.
And yeah, it just shows how young he was when he started out in the company and just how quickly it all turns around. I mean, he started in the company around like 94, 95. No, 93, wasn't it? Because he was in like one of the first few episodes of Raw.
Yeah.
So he was there for a long time, and it's always the thing that I like to come up to with the idea that when you talk about wrestlers' age, it's about their, like, stunt age, as it were. It's like somebody who hasn't wrestled for a long time but is considerably older has more value and more interest to people than someone who's younger but has been wrestling nonstop for about 10 years or whatever.
So to this day, he's only 47.
Mm.
And he has a son that is the age of 28. So really put that into perspective.
So, like I was saying, Nash is out injured until 2003. Waltman essentially has gone from the company from this point onwards. They decide to can the whole Michaels thing, because Michaels is essentially the only member of the NWO left at this point. Well, it's Shawn Michaels and the Big Show, but they decide to just can the Big Show side of it.
I think the only remnants of the NWO would be Big Show and Booker T, who were in the NWO together, then go on to feud and fight each other in a False Count Anywhere at Vengeance. Am I right?
I think they just called it a hardcore match.
Right.
I don't think it's False Count Anywhere, but it's definitely a hardcore match. And we will be reviewing that match, as well as all the rest of the stuff from Vengeance 2002, on a Patreon exclusive dark cast. If you want to sign up for the Patreon, you would need to unlock the... I think that would just be like the $10 tier, I think, for that one. I think it's just like anything that you get, like the typical dark cast on, like not the like Pick Your Poison or anything like that. Just any dark cast thing we'll put on there, you can just sign up to that tier and you'll be able to listen to essentially the extension of this series.
And while we're plugging the Patreon, we also do at least one dark cast a month. That's just, you know, me and Tony shooting the breeze. If you're a fan of something, like let's say you're into 2002 and you really want Callum and I to review every episode of Confidential for whatever reason, yeah, that would be good for the You Pick Your Poison tier. And go check that out on patreon.com/markoutmoment.
So other things that were going on this episode of Raw, RVD hit a, it's quite interesting because obviously we're talking about Heyman being in charge of SmackDown, but Heyman was as a performer on Raw at this point in time, managing Brock Lesnar, and he was hit with a Van Terminator on this episode of Raw.
First and only, I'm sure.
I think by the way that he sold it, I think it would be the only way of doing it, because you watch the clip as part of Vengeance as well, because they show that in the build-up to their match. And yeah, he doesn't sell it very well. Like, he's basically not holding the chair up against him in his face. It's basically hanging by his gut by the time that RVD reaches him from the other side of the ring.
He invented the move, or maybe not invented it, but he certainly encouraged it. And he doesn't take it very well, I will say that. Heyman was not a great in-ring performer.
The other notable thing, the other really historic thing that happens on this episode of Raw is a mixed tag team match with Bradshaw and Trish Stratus on one side of the ring and Christopher Nowinski and Jackie Gaider on the other.
Now, when you say notable, please define that word.
Notably horrible in every single way.
Okay.
So this is a mixed tag team match. I believe it won worst worked match of the year in The Observer for 2002. And there's some pretty stiff competition for this type of wrestling, but this was a whole new level of, this is like Maxine versus Caitlyn level of bad.
Is it as bad as Jenna Maraska meets Charmel?
I don't think it's that bad, because I went back and watched it just out of morbid curiosity, and it doesn't actually start that bad. Like Jackie and Trish do some okay stuff, and then it just really, it goes to shit when there's like some sort of Irish whip spot and they have no idea what they're doing with each other, and so it just gets really confusing. It's like one of those things where, oh, we don't have no idea what we're doing, so just get in a headlock and we'll talk about it for a couple of seconds. During the match, Bradshaw just chases Christopher Nowinski out of the ring, so we're just left with essentially a one-on-one between Trish and Jackie. And then there's that infamous missed bulldog spot where Trish overshoots it and then Jackie sells it anyway.
Fantastic.
Yeah, I would say if you're a fan of bad wrestling, then I'd check it out. And if you just want something to either laugh or cry over, that's also something that's worth checking out as well.
The one thing I do want to say about that match is that's Trish. And I mean, she is only 4 years later retiring and somehow widely regarded still as one of the greatest women's wrestlers of all time. So it really shows you her work ethic and the amount of time she put into perfecting the craft.
Which just a case of, I remember we're going to be reviewing Survivor Series at some point, and her hardcore match with Victoria is great.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of the blame can be put on Jackie's shoulders for that one incident. But we'll move on now to the actual reason we're here, which is the July 11th, 2002 episode of SmackDown, recorded, obviously, as usual, 2 days earlier on July the 9th. From the Boardwalk Hall in Atlantic City, New Jersey.
I like that WWE at this point is still running a lot of just Northeast areas. Like, we're still not fully out of the woods there. Mm. And they just have, like, these strongholds in Jersey, and they're always in New York at the Garden and whatnot.
Well, because we're in Atlantic City in the Boardwalk, we have some celebrity involvement in the crowd with Busta Rhymes.
That's fun.
And we'll definitely be hearing a little bit more about him as we go on. They don't actually show, there is a, it's obviously not a clip that we see through the episode of SmackDown, but there is a behind the scenes essential clip of The Rock and Busta Rhymes singing on the Boardwalk, which you can see in probably some sort of like Rock DVD, or there's probably a clip on YouTube somewhere if you just like search for it. It's a nice touch with this. It's you know, time when wrestling was able to attract people of that kind of caliber and coolness.
Yeah, this was still like WWE still attracting top name celebrities. You still had The Rock. That's one of the huge pulls here for this show. One of the most interesting things to me, knowing what we know now about how long matches go today, there's not a match here that exceeds 6 minutes.
Well, it is still very much the bridge between the Attitude Era and now. I mean, Attitude Era is famed for having matches that would just go on for 2 or 3 minutes and then end in disqualifications or countouts. And There's certain signs, not in this episode in particular, but as we move forward, of matches that are given time to breathe and are given the proper dues. But definitely in this example, this is a sign of, yep, this is very Attitude Era style wrestling.
The longest match on the show is the main event, and that only goes 6:22. And when you hear the names that are in that match, you'll be rather shocked.
Well, let's talk about the names that are in that match, because there's a recap segment of the last week's controversy where Kurt Angle seemingly made The Undertaker tap out while he was being pinned. And so they announced their world title match as a draw. And so Vince has announced that it's only fair that the main event of Vengeance will now be The Undertaker versus Kurt Angle versus The Rock for the Undisputed Championship.
Very simple, very plain. The interest of fairness is a term that was thrown around a lot back in those days. Kind of like how later on they would use best for business. And that's one of those like classic Vince-isms to me.
So, but the main event of this show is Undertaker teaming with the rookie, John Cena, to take on the team of Kurt Angle and Chris Jericho. That's one Hall of Famer and three future Hall of Famers.
And again, they only go a little over 6 minutes. And you look at this now and you begin to understand why John Cena says he failed with his initial push, because wow, it looks like they skyrocketed him to the moon.
Yeah, I don't want to say like a Roman Reigns styles push, because Roman Reigns was pretty popular before they did start pushing him quite a bit. But he's getting like the Rocky Maivia treatment straight away, really.
Like, I do think in watching this, it's allowed me to, when you compare him to Roman, say the difference between John and Roman is John was allowed to grow and change. And I think that growth and that change really helped John Cena become a big time superstar.
Oh, absolutely. I also think that the big difference is that Reigns had a group behind him and a group surrounding him that had different personalities and characteristics that people could get behind all of them together and see qualities in them individually. Cena's kind of hung out to dry on his own and immediately cast among main eventers. So
that is true.
It's something that, especially when we come to watch Vengeance, it's something that immediately castigates him from the audience, because they just see him as another, they just see him as a blue chip babyface with no personality that's just been elevated to the main event without paying his dues.
You know, and you're going to see him at some point. We don't cover Velocity. We could if you donate to the Pick Your Poison, but you'll see him be relegated to Velocity, and you find that these pushes straight away don't work out.
So here's the first of two championship matches tonight, which is a rematch from last week with Edge and Hulk Hogan defending their newly won World Tag Team Championships against Billy and Chuck. So the automatic rematch clause still in effect at this point in time. Crowd is obviously immensely crazy for Hulk Hogan. He's the big attraction of this match. He's coming out like playing his title belt like a guitar.
Amazing.
Yeah. Edge runs wild for a bit, but Billy takes over with a Tilt the World Slam. I think that there's like this, the thing with Hulk Hogan in a tag team is that you want Hulk Hogan to be the hot tag.
Right.
Because, or at least like one of the hot tags, because how unbelievably over he is. But the thing is, Hulk Hogan can't really do hot tags at his age. So what you have to do is make the hot tag to Hogan, and then Hogan looks at the crowd in amazement and then slowly ambles into the ring while the other wrestler just stares in disbelief that this guy is about to enter the ring.
Well, to be fair, and I know what you're saying, but I kind of think that was Hogan's hot tag from like 92 onward, where it's just like, it's the sheer amazement of, oh my god, Hulk Hogan is now legal. Oh my god, Billy Gunn is going to get in there with Hulk Hogan. And he's allowed to do his signature Hogan stuff, and easy peasy.
It just feels so much like the opposite of what you expect from a hot tag.
Oh, because it's not, you're saying it's not like,
It's very not like fiery. You make the tag and then you're immediately into the action and you're fresh and you're excited and you really want to get at somebody. It's make the hot tag, pander to the crowd for a little while. The other guy has to just stand there and wait for you to like crawl into the ring and finally start hitting them. It, obviously, it's wrestling and that's the pantomime of it, but and it works because it's Hogan, but it's just still, it's not a hot tag.
Right. I can understand that.
It's the coolest hot tag in history. Rico pulls Hogan's leg when he tries to do the leg drop, so Edge spears him off the apron. Then Billy Gunn hits the Famouser on Hulk Hogan. Just like for a second, people think, oh my god, they're just going to have him job to Billy out of Billy and Chuck.
Yeah, the day that Hulk Hogan lost to Billy Gunn would have been the day that Hulk Hogan just hung up the boots.
So Hogan kicks out and immediately hulks up. He does his punches to the head. He does the big boot. Hits a leg drop after Edge spears Chuck when he tried to interfere. And yeah, the champs retain. So definitely not as good as the title winning match from last week. But, you know, like the crowd is really into it because they like Edge, but they love Hogan. And all four guys work well together, so it wasn't a big deal.
Yeah, I like the match a lot. I think it's very good for what it was, you know?
So Undertaker is waiting in the parking lot for The Rock when John Cena turns up, and obviously the blue chip babyface just wants to shake Undertaker's hand and says, wow, I can't believe we're teaming together tonight. I'm just going to go out there and do my best. And Taker just says that he doesn't give a damn about teaming with John Cena, and he's just waiting for The Rock to turn up so he can kick his ass.
Right, because we're very firmly cemented in tweener Undertaker, who just wants to kick everybody's ass, I guess, and the main heel going into Vengeance would be Kurt Angle.
So we have a clip of Troy Wilson having a photo shoot on the beach in a bikini. When Molly Holly turns up and she has to like wade through the water in like her, she's wearing like pretty full length trousers or pants in America, and no shoes or socks. And so she wades up to Tori and just says that winning the Golden Fong Award is not the same as winning a women's championship, which I think we can all agree it's not. So
yeah, I think that's fair. That's very fair.
And so she, the champion, challenges Tori, you know, the Golden Fong winner, to have a championship match with her to prove her superiority.
Now, if I'm Molly, I can kind of get behind this because, you know, she just wants to prove that, hey, I want to get in the ring with you because, you know, screw you for being a top star, for just having a good look.
Yeah, but I just find it hilarious with the idea that, like, Tori almost has to, like, reluctantly accept. Like, she thinks about it for a while. She's been offered an opportunity at the Women's Championship. She goes, okay, I'll do it. It's like rather than like, yeah, let's do it. Let's go into it. So how things would have things have changed. I know that's kind of an instance of like, I don't think there is no place for, I don't say eye candy, but like just managers or personalities that are women that are just there for mainly their looks or their personalities as opposed to their wrestling ability. So, but it's just a case of like, well, Tori does wrestle on the show, and it's not like they're shying away from the fact that she does actually wrestle from time to time. And she's just very nonchalant about the fact that she's going to be given a women's title match.
Yeah, because she's Tori, and Tori just never seemed to care.
So Tori accepts, and then she decides to do what she does best, which is remove the string of her bikini top take a few more action shots and annoy Molly, who at this point is the very like model, like total virgin. What's the phrase, like chastity, and like just being a model citizen and not being built around her wrestling ability rather than her looks.
She would have been really good for Right to Censor.
Oh, absolutely. That's pretty much where they probably got the idea from. It's just their next attempt at doing that.
The reality is Molly was somebody who, even around the sleazy business of wrestling, remained a virgin till marriage. And, you know, people probably weren't a fan of that.
It's just very, I mean, you don't hear it much on SmackDown because the King isn't a commentator on SmackDown, but the stuff that Jerry the King Lawler would say during her matches, during this gimmick, it's just... I mean, this is Lawler when he's not being reined in and stuff like that. Back in 2002, when nobody gave a crap about what people were saying about women and different like minority groups. It's horrible, 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 but we'll get onto that match a little bit later on. Instead, we've got to go back to The Undertaker, who's now being surrounded by producers, including Finlay, the Brooklyn Brawler, and John Laurinaitis.
The soon-to-be executive vice president of talent relations, John Laurinaitis.
So they're trying to get into inside the building when a limo shows up, and so Undertaker assumes it's The Rock, and he's going in there to get some action. But instead, it's Angle and Jericho, who for some reason have hired a limo to get to the building. Angle mocks Undertaker for tapping out last week, whereas Undertaker says that he pinned Angle. Jericho refers to him as the Undertapper. And then everyone just starts brawling. So they fight. They've got a 2-on-1 advantage over the Undertaker, but they all get separated by the producers. McMahon shows up and he's furious. And he tells Taker that he has The Rock later, but only once he's inside the arena. And so Undertaker reluctantly leaves. Come back from break. Even more Undertaker. God, it's the Undertaker show tonight. And he enters the locking room and he's like throwing furniture and he's angry. Hocko, Holly and Big Dalboski are in there and they leave. And that just leaves John Cena. So Undertaker shouts at John Cena for leaving, even though Undertaker asked John Cena to leave and said that he didn't give a crap about him at all. And so Cena just calls him out on the bullshit, and then Undertaker says that he basically uses this as an opportunity to say that he doesn't trust John Cena, he doesn't think John Cena has his back. I mean, Undertaker's such a dick. In these segments, he's such a dick.
The sad thing is, I believe that's the closest thing to him being himself that he ever let show on TV.
Yeah, just like, okay, I'm really annoyed because I just got like ambushed by two guys. I'm going to take it out on the rookie in the locker room.
So what do you think about, you mentioned it's the Undertaker show, and I'm guessing you're not a fan of that?
I'm not a fan of this Undertaker, and I think I've made it pretty plain that's playing in the 2001 Wrestling Odyssey and now, that this biker Undertaker gimmick, and I absolutely agree with you that this is probably more of an embodiment of the actual person, and that's why I'm not a big fan of the Undertaker in general, because he doesn't come across as a... He comes across as like a pretty laid-back individual personality in reality, and I don't think he's a bad person, he's just a bit... I wouldn't want to hang out with him in real life.
You know, I think that's fair. I like the idea of being able to spend an episode on such a consistent story, because I think nowadays you look back on it and WWE really just runs through segments now, and like Brock Lesnar is in the opening segment and then he's gone and you don't hear about it again for 3 hours, whereas in a 2-hour show they told a lot with The Undertaker.
No, I definitely think that that's a better way of doing it. I just wish they did it with somebody else.
Fair.
We'll move on to the actual Women's Championship match now. So they hype up the next WWF Confidential, which is going to be a segment that's dedicated to Tori Wilson's like life and what she does day to day. And then a special one, what happened to Jimmy Snooker? Like, you don't want to know what happened to Jimmy Snooker.
Oh, wow. That's funny now, but I can't believe they would go there.
So Tori immediately slaps Molly in the face and hits two scoop slams. Taz on commentary is talking about the fact that how Molly is technically refined and that Tori is gorgeous. That's basically his tale of the tape. Like, Molly, great technical wrestler, really experienced. Tori, well, she's hot. She's a hot tomato. That's basically what we're dealing with. A hideous catapult by Tori onto Molly. But I actually have Molly take the blame for that, really, because it's a catapult, so most of the work is being done by the guy or girl that's launching themselves. So I kind of think if something goes wrong in a catapult, it's down to the person trying to projectile themselves.
You know, I said this last time we saw a Tori Wilson match, and I don't hate Tori or anything, obviously far from it, but God, I'm so glad we're away from all of that.
So we have the finish is Tori gets powerbombed by Molly Holly, And instead of like pinning her straight away or doing like the sit out power one pin, she applies this like leg lace type move where she gets him into a really unique looking, almost like they're forming like an Eiffel Tower almost in the pinfall. So that's a unique pinning combination. I just don't think it was very necessary. It's just a nice little flourish at the end of it.
And all of that happened within 2 minutes.
Yep, Moni wins. Let's move straight on. Rock arrives backstage and everyone's excited because The Rock's back and he's back on SmackDown, The Rock Show.
And you know, I never understood this thing of like these top stars just getting to the show while the show's on the air.
So we move on to the hottest feud on SmackDown right now, which is Randy Orton and insert tag team partner name here against Reverend Devon and Batista.
And who's the tag team partner this week, Callum?
Well, this time he decides to bring out the big guns and goes with the world's strongest man, Mark Henry.
Now this is a good time for Mark Henry. Mark Henry, you know, he's doing the strongest man. He's probably legitimately the strongest man in the world at this point. And I think he's got a shot against Batista.
So what would happen is that, like, prior to the match, we see, like, a backstage segment where Orton is talking about how his previous partners let him down in the other matches. And so he's turned to Mark Henry. So it's basically like Orton is, let's say, are these other veterans that I've turned to, they couldn't do shit for me, and so I keep losing because they aren't putting their weight, and so now I'm turning to you instead.
Interesting. You think this is an intentional start of a heel turn?
Potentially. I don't know for certain. I just, knowing how WWE sometimes book baby faces, it might just be them thinking that, oh, him being a little bit of a dick, that's fine, because The Rock was a bit of a dick and he got super over for it.
Not wrong.
This match basically runs pretty much the same as every other tag team match we've seen from these, like, well, three and plus one person. But Henry makes the hot tag. He runs wild. He's actually, like, getting the better of Batista and Devon. And then there's this one spot, which I think is, like, it might be the reason why Orton doesn't do this move anymore. He hits Devon at about 100 miles per hour with a crossbody off the top rope after being thrown by Henry. And, like, because Devon's charging at them and Orton's, like, flying off the apron. It's the hardest hit of a diving crossbody I think I've ever seen.
Do you know when about he stopped using that crossbody? Because that used to be a very signature move for him.
I think it was around about, like, 2004, 2005-ish when he starts doing the, the Legend Killer stuff because he was doing that in 2003 or whatever, but he starts just going to more of a mat-based or like slow style that he's more familiar with now, and he stops doing that stuff. I think he's kind of the point where he thinks, oh, well, I should be a main eventer now. I can't be doing diving crossbodies off the top rope.
I think that's good. That's fair.
So Batista gets Henry on his shoulders and he performs a rolling senton move, which is impressive. And then he spine busters Henry and he gets a pin. So at least Orton didn't get pinned in this match. The Thugs pin Henry instead. I think that's probably a signal of where they see Henry in the pecking order at this point. So,
you know, Henry, the weirdest thing about Mark Henry to me is that he's in the company forever. And at about this point, he's still 9 years away from his big break.
Yeah, I don't know if this is still the point. I think they see some use in him at this point because of the World's Strongest Man thing, but it can't be too far removed from the point where they were just trying to give him ridiculous gimmicks to try and get him to quit on his massive contract with the company.
Yeah, and he's still with the company somehow. So good on Mark Henry. World's strongest resolve, I say.
So Edge and Hulk Hogan are celebrating backstage about their title win and how they're going to be heading to the casino soon. And they do this comedy segment where The Rock enters from behind. And Hogan notices him because he sees it, but he pretends that The Rock isn't there, so he starts talking down about him and starts making jokes at his expense. And so The Rock gets annoyed about it, and they get into a friendly argument about how things happened at WrestleMania and how they're going to catch up and go to the casino later. It's typical Rock comedy segment.
And I think Rock at this point, it's like, you know, he's out the door. So watching it back, you're just sort of like, okay, it's the tail end of his run. Now we know that. At the time, it was just, you know, standard Rock affair. So it was probably hit or miss with people watching the show.
So part of this segment, Edge says that he thinks that Mr. Nanny would beat the Scorpion King in a fight. Rob, where do you stand on that argument?
I think neither one of them did too well in the box office, but I happen to know Scorpion King did a whole lot better than Mr. Nanny. So Hakuma Shinte, I say.
I think it depends on how good the CGI is, really, in the match. Because if the CGI is not up to the amazing standards of the Scorpion King or like the Mummy Returns, then there's no way the Scorpion King could live up to Mr. Nanny.
Oh, for sure. I mean, Mr. Nanny was the thing that got Hulk Hogan to say, hey, brother, I'm leaving wrestling.
That is the worst CGI ever, like pretty much of any movie, right?
Yeah, oh yeah.
So The Rock comes to the ring, gets an absolutely unbelievable ovation. So he's basically, you know, it's him and Hogan. They're the two big stars of the entire show at the moment. Somebody tosses him the mic from the outside, which I thought was a nice touch. We don't see enough of that. Just like the guy at ring. It's like him getting the mic thrown at him and Austin getting beers thrown at him. That's only the really time that the production crew really gets involved in somebody's entrance. Well, I guess like the people around ringside.
Right. And at the time, it was only certain top names who were, you know, bringing in the other people just to have a little fun.
So Rock panders to the crowd for a little while, does his usual shtick. He cuts a promo on The Undertaker and sells him to Just Bring It, but instead Kurt Angle comes out. Angle says that he's the one that Rock should be worried about, vengeance, and lists all his recent accomplishments, says he plans to make the Rock tap out at Vengeance 2. He notes that P. Diddy's in the crowd when it's actually Busta Rhymes.
Good.
That joke wouldn't go... Oh, would that joke still be fine in 2020?
If you take it for what it is, it's like, it's funny because
Kurt Angle knows nothing about rap music.
Yeah. So like, he just sees that and he's like, I know the name P. Diddy, that's P. Diddy. But I'm sure it probably wouldn't go over too well in 2020.
Yeah, some people would read negatively against it, but I think it was fairly harmless. I think they've drummed it into the Angle character enough that the reason why that would be is because he's a goofball that doesn't know anything about rap music, rather than him just saying, oh, that's that guy.
It's a black guy, it looks like a black guy, yeah.
You have to wait until 2005 before he had that gimmick.
Oof.
He basically mocks the fact that the last time that he was on SmackDown, Kurt Angle had hair, so he has no idea who this guy is, because Angle's bald now.
That's funny.
And so this ends with like a barrage of Dr. Evil jokes. Because why wouldn't you do it? The $1 million.
Well, to be fair, Austin Powers at this point is still pretty high. So, yeah, I think you can get away with that.
They're actually, I don't know if it was this episode, but it was a previous episode, wasn't it, where we talked about the fact they were advertising Goldmember.
Right.
Because... So Goldmember came out in 2002. I did some looking into that because I was just somewhere. Like, that was Beyonce's first movie.
It was.
Do you know how old she was in that movie?
No.
She was 20.
Shut up!
No, because I'm looking at... I mean, it may be 2021, but, like, she's not 40 now. She's not even 40. And that was 18 years ago.
Get out of here!
She's 38, I think, now. So, yeah, she'd be 21 at the oldest.
Wow.
She was still, like, just coming out of, like, the Destiny's Child phase as well. So it's like... Like, so, and she'd been performing since like 97, so she'd been performing since she was about like 16.
I know, it's so... She was young in Destiny's Child, but I feel like she's been on top of the world forever. And you're telling me she was only 20 when she did Goldmember. Yeah, so crazy.
Yeah. So we have a recap of the Un-Americans interrupting Lillian Garcia's rendition of the Star Spangled Banner. It was Star Spangled Banner, wasn't it? Not America the Beautiful.
It was Star Spangled Banner, yeah.
Okay. So we lead to a match between Test and Rikishi. So Lance Storm and Christian come out on commentary. Test and Rikishi start the match on the floor because it's still remnants of the Attitude Era. As soon as they get in the ring, Test hits clothesline and Rikishi does his classic flip dive spot. Rikishi dominates, gets Test into the stink face position. That leads to Lance Storm and Christian interfering. Test barely gets up, hits him with the pump handle slam for two. He barely gets him up for the pump handle slam. I don't know whether I'm impressed that he managed to even just get him up for the pump handle slam, or more bewildered about why he even attempted that spot in the first place.
I would be bewildered.
Test blocks the banzai drop with the knees to the crutch. Then he runs into a ugly looking Samoan drop and Rikishi wins. So it's over in a matter of minutes. This probably went about a similar length of time as the women's title match.
It did, and again, like we had said earlier, it's amazing how much they got done in less than 7 minutes, because all these matches are that.
But it's just a case of, we've seen two matches between these two in like one-on-one action, and I don't think they work well together at all.
That's fair.
This match was slightly better than the previous one, but they're quite ugly matches. Lance Storm Christian attacked Rikishi after the bell, but he's saved by Edge and Hulk Hogan. And that's the prelude to what would end up being the World Tag Team title match at Vengeance.
And I was going to say, that also leads us into what will be a six-man tag next week.
Absolutely. But for now, we're going backstage to seeing Vince McMahon and Stacy groping each other. But essentially, it's like they're basically teasing about the fact that they're going to take each other's clothes off. Because, yeah, you know, Vince is so unbelievably virile and attractive to women half his age.
To all women. Vince is a very powerful and attractive man. This is really awkward to watch right now.
To be fair, the thing with Stacy almost made sense, because Stacy was definitely only doing it for the money, because she was pretty much, for the most part, disgusted by having to be associated, or at least in character, having to be disgusted by being associated with McMahon. So at least she played that character well, rather than people like Trish and Sable and Candice Michelle, who seem to be like literally enamored with Vince McMahon.
So awkward.
So Jericho interrupts, and Vince says that he wants to see Edge and Hogan defend the titles against the Un-Americans at Vengeance, but that would mean that Chris Jericho can't have his match with Edge, which is already in booked. So Vince just asks him politely if he's okay with like skipping out of his match at Vengeance, and he'll pay him back for that down the road. And so Jericho agrees. So that means that he doesn't have to work Vengeance, and he's going to get a reward for Vince for not wrestling.
Yeah, that good logic by the heel. I think this makes perfect sense.
So we move on. So we move on to another video segment, a pre-recorded segment of Noble, Nidia, and Tajiri and like a restaurant eating an all-you-can-eat buffet. Noble picks up a piece of meat and says it's the finest piece of meat he's ever seen, and Nidia says, "Well, except for me."
Yeah.
Hideously sexist, unless you know the characters, in which case it makes total sense, and I'm totally down for it.
Still, still hideously sexist, but, like, this is where we were, and I think all the characters played their parts very well.
Yeah. Wow. So they do the spaghetti spot with, like, a make-out session because they're hicks. Noble informs Tajiri they have a rematch with Kim and Hurricane tonight, so they're going to want to get the better of it this time. Noble says that the title means more to him than anything else, and how it's his ticket to never being poor again. Again, love the fact that he sells the importance of the title so much, like the title's changed his life, all that other great stuff.
Really, if you are champion, you should be making more money.
Absolutely. And you should feel really great about having the title belt. It should mean more than just, you know, the status that comes with it. It should be that you're the big star anymore. Like, it's part of the reason why Ric Flair's gimmick works so well, because once he won a world championship, he was the biggest star in the entire, came across as like the biggest star in the whole world to wrestling
and
fans.
He was able to live his lavish and insane life because he was a world champion 16 times around.
Yeah, and Noble's like a very different version of Flair in that his version of a lavish lifestyle was running water.
Yeah. Perfect.
So they do the Raw recap with the premise of Triple H potentially joining the NWO, while Colin Taz give an update on Kevin Nash's injury. Says that he'll basically be out for a while. I think they noted that he'd underwent surgery on his quadriceps, so we won't see him again until 2003.
And I think this might be the last we ever mentioned Kevin Nash on this podcast.
Yeah, I'd imagine so. And I'm not sad about it.
Yeah, I know how you feel.
We move on to the Cruiserweight Tag Team match. Jamie Noble and Tajiri facing Billy Kidman and the Hurricane. So within a minute, Kidman has launched Noble into a powerbomb by the Hurricane. So this is Cruiserweight Wrestling in 2002. This is a point in time where, even though some of the main eventers are doing more of this high-impact wrestling style, you can still distinguish the Cruiserweights from the main eventers for the most part.
And right. And
these guys are really fast-paced and they're doing really good stuff.
And more importantly, they're doing stuff that you won't see anywhere else. Like,
yeah,
this is their division and that's it.
So Noble does a really cool spot where he slides through the Hurricane's legs, but he's grabbing the arm while he does it. So he uses that to transition into a pump handle suplex. People don't talk enough about how good Jamie Noble was in the ring.
Yeah, you're starting to hear a lot of praise for him as a producer, but I think he's really underrated as a performer.
Hurricane blocks the handspring elbow with the kick to the back, which probably looked like it sucked for Tajiri, but that was still good. There was Noble misses suicide dive from the outside when Kidman escapes, and so he just hits Tajiri instead. They do a diving sent onto the floor by the Hurricane on both of his opponents. Nidia tries to pull Kidman off the apron while he's going for the shooting star, so that allows Noble to get onto the turnbuckle and try and hit a superplex, but Kidman blocks it and hits a Mikane bomb from the top rope and pins Noble. So Kidman has a pin over the champion, and this would end up leading to Kidman getting a title shot at the Cruiserweight title with Vengeance.
This was a 3-minute affair. Everything Callum just mentioned, all that high impact offense, was 3 minutes long.
Yep, it's just very, very typical of the time frame.
Hitting your marks and just still managing to make an impact. I think that's a lost art form in a way.
I think that it still makes an impact. I mean, like, I see all these four guys work, and you just see that they're at a, especially at this point in time, I don't say they're at a different level, but they're just working at such a fast pace, and they're putting some real good stuff together. It's a very, very modern match at a time frame where they were only really starting to transition into that style.
I love it.
So we have Rock backstage with Mark Lloyd. And Rock basically asks how Coach got shorter and white. And then he does this thing where he's just like, oh my god, you're Mark Lloyd? Like Mark Lloyd? Yeah, it's like how excited like he's been interviewed by Mark Lloyd. And says, I just have one question for you. Who the hell is Mark Lloyd? And then just like kicks him out of shot.
The Rock... I would dare say a character like The Rock wouldn't be much of a babyface in 2020.
But he shouldn't have been a babyface at any point in time.
He's so perfectly an asshole, and it just works.
So, like, Rock cuts a promo about how he's not going anywhere, while Taker and Angle's still there. He says that he's pulled a slot machine called Vengeance, and it shows three Brahma balls, and he's going to win the Undisputed title with Vengeance. And then he makes a quip about how Mark Lloyd is masturbating off screen to what The Rock's saying, and then we end the segment. It's just, yeah, Rock's back on SmackDown. He's cutting hilarious promos.
You know,
that's what you think.
It's funny, because you look at Dwayne Johnson now, and Dwayne Johnson is very pro. He's very all for equality and all for everybody feeling good. The Rock is such a dick. And you wouldn't believe that that idea could come from a person who's so giving and loving and humble.
Yeah, there's certain people that just have a character that's just so outside of what the personality is.
But it's yeah, fantastic.
We have another Rey Mysterio hype package. He's still 2 weeks away from seeing his debut match. Worth waiting for. And we're already on to the main event, which is The Undertaker team with John Cena against Kurt Angle and Chris Jericho. A dream match in basically every other year, probably from 2005 onwards.
Yeah, and I mean, like, if you were telling me this now, I assume you're talking about some kind of Saudi Arabian show. Like, what a talented lineup this is.
So Cena takes the brunt of the offense early from Angle and Jericho, but Cena fights out until Jericho hits this really, I don't want to say ugly, because it wasn't ugly, but it was gnarly looking missile drop kick, which really connects with Cena. Like, I looked at that and just thought, there's no way he didn't just kick Cena in the face.
Paying his dues.
Yep, that's. I don't think he's still getting the credit for it, at least from the fan base at this point in time. He hits Angle with his really ugly power slam, which I still hate. That's just. It's not a power slam. I don't know what it is. You're lifting the guy up and putting him down. It doesn't work for me.
You're talking about the. He's just gonna. It's a very ugly looking power slam.
It's where you lift the guy up and don't do any sort of rotation whatsoever. Just put him down after turning your body slightly.
Yeah, it is not the ability of the the current Randy Orton power slam.
No, it's in a completely different universe to the Randy Orton power slam. Undertaker makes the hot tag, does his massive clotheslines in the corner to both Angle and Jericho. He goes to chokeslam Angle, but Jericho tries to stop him. He tries to stop him, but he hits Angle and the referee at the same time. So we have a ref bump. Angle slams to Undertaker, but Jericho can't recover quickly enough to cover him because of the referee being down. Undertaker punches Jericho as he goes for the lion salt on Cena. So Cena's back in the ring. He's tagged in. And Undertaker goes for the... Undertaker's on the outside, and Jericho goes for the lion salt, and Undertaker punches him off the middle rope, which I thought was a really good spot. Just a nice little transition. And so Cena uses that distraction to get Jericho into an Oklahoma roll, and he gets his first win by pinning Chris Jericho.
In the main event of an episode of SmackDown. Now, if you saw this with Humberto Carrillo today...
Tony would be angry.
People would be livid. I mean, and that was, I think, another wake-up call to, like, all right, we don't want any, you know, blue-chip baby faces.
It's clearly, like, a sign of, like, this guy who we didn't know even existed until, like, 3 weeks ago, unless you were a big fan of OVW. He's, like, already fighting, like, not just fighting, but winning against former world champions.
And I think, like, that's... When you look at John Cena's progression, it's important to realize why NXT is what it is today. Because now you build these guys through NXT that if they just show up on Raw, they're basically already main event level guys.
That is true, but there's also the argument to say that Cena getting this sort of treatment and being pushed up immediately ended up benefiting him a lot more in the long run.
Oh, for sure. And I think when we talk about the talent in the match, the fact that he was able to work with and learn from Undertaker, Jericho, and Angle on a consistent basis is something that future generations wouldn't have. So he was allowed to become the top star like that.
So the action isn't over with the pinfall as Jericho attacks Cena off the bell, throws him out of the ring. Taker boots Jericho, but then he's hit with Angle's German suplex and locked into the ankle lock. They continue to fight. They basically just have another singles match in the ring for a little while where Taker applies a Dragon Sleeper to Angle. And he was using the Dragon Sleeper every now and again to try and get people to tap out instead of just using the Last Ride or the Chokeslam or the Tombstone. But then Rock runs out. He rock buttons Taker, like takes out both guys. But then Angle attacks him behind. He goes for the Rock's, you know, spit punch, where you just, like, hit him multiple times and get sorted. Yeah. But Rock blocks him, hit his own, then he hits a rock bottom to Angle, and so Rock's the one standing tall over both of his opponents at the end of it. He's signalling that he's going to be the Undisputed Champion. So, yeah, it's a hot finish to the show. It gets the guy that everyone really came to this show to see over. And, yeah, but that's really kind of it for this episode. It's not one that lives long in the memory. Like, as soon as you watched it, you're pretty much forgotten about it.
I would argue, especially now, you know, great show, does its job. If you're a young guy or a guy who just is invested in WWE, you're excited for Vengeance, and it doesn't overstay its welcome.
I would say there's nothing hideously bad on this episode. I wasn't a big fan of, obviously, the multiple Undertaker segments, and obviously the women's title match was a women's title match in 2002, so nothing much to write home about, but it did its job, like you said. There was nothing overstayed its welcome, they got things done, and yeah, there's nothing to hate about it. I just don't think there's really anything to love about it either.
Right. And... But, I thought it was good. It wouldn't be my favorite episode that we've covered, and it won't be my favorite episode by the time this whole thing is done.
No.
But, yeah, good episode for what it was.
So that ends an episode for us here, and hopefully it was a good one for you guys. Hopefully you enjoyed it. So that's the end of episode 3. We'll just do a little bit of a preview of what you can expect from episode 4, which is... Oh, okay. I'm just checked over my notes again. So episode 4 is when shit goes down. Because we're done with this whole Vincent Mann's in charge of everything, because we are now entering a, well, decade plus era of the general managers.
Oh, yeah.
So we've got Eric Bischoff on Raw, and we're about to have Stephanie McMahon on SmackDown. And I can tell you from like some of the episodes that I reviewed in like advance of this, so much is about to change, and I don't think it's for the better. But we'll wait and see. We'll cover all those ones as well. So episode 4, we've got the big Stephanie McMahon announcements. We have the main event of The Rock versus Kurt Angle on an episode of SmackDown in 2002. So
amazing.
Look forward to that one. The six-man tag that we referenced earlier, so Hulk Hogan, Edge, and Rikishi against all three members of the Un-Americans.
Got Randy Orton's not on this card. What's up with that?
No, we'll talk about that. We've got another Chris Jericho, John Cena match. We've got the return of Hardcore Porn, Hardcore Holly, and the Big Balboski teaming up against Billy and Chuck. So much stuff to get excited about. So we'll look forward to that episode as well. Hopefully you'll join us for that one as well, whether it's through the podcast feeds or whether it's on YouTube. Just join us and enjoy the show. Hopefully, if you want to go back and watch it in advance, do so. You can join in the conversation about what you thought about this episode and how you thought it went down. But time to move on to the plugs at the end of the show. So you can sign up for the Mega Maniacs on Facebook. If you want to join in other conversations, or you want to put forward any other ideas or suggestions you may have for what we can do to fill in some extra content here and there, because we don't always have stuff to do on a week-to-week basis. So if you have any ideas, suggestions, or we put a poll up there for what we're planning on doing, you can have your say on what sort of content you want to see on our regular feed here. We've obviously mentioned the Patreon. Donate however much you want, even a dollar goes a long way to helping us just keep the lights on and keeping us motivated to keep producing this new and interesting content for everyone. There's obviously other ways you can help us financially, is buying merchandise through Redbubble, TeePublic, Amango Tees, Fanboys Anonymous, and Smile Cut Moment. Get your masks, be socially responsible, and also look cool while doing it by having some Smile Cut Moment merchandise over your face.
Yes, if you want a mask that just says Happy Days, it's there. It's everything is there, including the However Bell, all those silly designs. Protect yourself while supporting the boys. And you can also support the sister website, the blue brand of Fanboys Anonymous, and that's mostly Tony over there doing the geek culture reviews and stuff. You can check out Tony on Instagram, Twitter, at Tony Mango. And am I missing any of Tony's plugs, Kel?
I think if he wanted more of his plugs said, he'd bother to show up to some of these ones instead.
You know, so. Yeah, screw you, Tony. No, obviously we love Tony. But my plugs, very quickly, WrestleZone, Fightful, those are the two sites I work for. Those continue to get your wrestling news from there. WrestleZone was around in 2002, given the scoops, still around today. And you can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at DudeFelice.
So, yep, you can follow me on Twitter at WeekMeister14. Check out all the articles on SmileCatMoment.com. Follow SmileCatMoment on Facebook, Twitter, all the other platforms we're on. And, yeah, that's it for us here, and we'll hopefully see you for episode 4. But for now, this has been another SmileCat Moment, and we are being counted out.